Funds for the California Report are provided by Charitable Auto Resources, supporting nonprofits in California and nationwide through vehicle donations at www.donationprogram.info. The James Irvine Foundation, celebrating the 2009 recipients of the James Irvine Foundation Leadership Awards. More information is available at www.irvine.org. And the Walter S. Johnson Foundation.
This is the California Report. I'm Scott Schaefer. Coming up, scientists in California are planning a return trip to the moon next week. So why are they hoping for a crash landing? And how public schools in one border town are feeling the recession's pinch.
Our kinder classrooms, they used to be packed with parents before, trying to be involved in all kinds of activities. Now we hardly see them.
Also, the pop culture artist known as Coop, and what Chinese politicians are learning about democracy in California.
For them to come into classroom in California and sit there and have to listen to, you know, lectures about ethics and about empowering, you know, citizens, I give them credit.
This is the California Report. Forty years ago next month, two Apollo 11 astronauts thrilled the world, becoming the first men to land on the moon.
Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed.
Roger, Tranquility. We copy you on the ground.
That lunar landing had all of Mission Control holding its breath as Neil Armstrong landed the Eagle with less than 30 seconds of fuel left. Next week, NASA scientists in Silicon Valley are planning a return to the moon, and this time, a crash landing is the goal. David Gorn explains.
John Marmee is heading toward the heart of the moon rocket launch.
I gotta get to the door here.
Through the labyrinth that is NASA Ames Research Center in Mountain View.
All right, so this is actually our Science Operations Center. We call it the SOC.
It's from here that NASA officials, including Deputy Project Manager Marmee, will track the flight of their moon rocket from next Wednesday's launch at Cape Canaveral in Florida to October's impact into the lunar surface. The mission is called LCROSS, for Lunar Crater Observation and Sensing Satellite. It represents a new chapter in our 40-year-old exploration of the moon, Marmee says.
The Centaur is 2,000 kilograms, about the size of a large SUV.
And that 4,400-pound rocket, he says, will be moving pretty fast.
Going twice the speed of a bullet, so about 5,500 miles per hour we're heading in.
So scientists are hoping for an impressive impact. Now, back in 1998, another NASA probe found a suggestion of frozen water at the moon's poles. The theory is that long ago, a comet hit the moon, depositing a huge field of ice there at the frigid South Pole, and that ice is hidden just below the surface. It costs roughly $100,000 a gallon to carry water to the moon. So if NASA can find water there, Marmee says, that would have a rippling effect on its space exploration plans.
We want to go back to the moon to possibly colonize and be a stepping stone to go to other planets, you know, to Mars and beyond. So this is that first step where it's sort of like the Lewis and Clark expedition.
Another larger robotic spacecraft will remain in the moon's orbit for at least a year, looking at future landing sites. But first, the spacecraft will release the Centaur rocket. That impact will send a plume of rock and dust, and hopefully ice crystals, high above the lunar surface, about 37 miles high. And that bright puff of moon dust will be visible from Earth. The whole Moon Impact Project was put together here at NASA Ames. Tony Colaprete is the project's principal investigator, and he's walking through the cavernous testing area.
And so what we have here is a vibration table.
There's one machine that shakes objects, simulating liftoff at about 14 Gs.
On liftoff, we feel the shakes. When we actually separate, those are pyro events, they're little explosions. Those create shocks, you know, bangs.
And the shock machine is just down the aisle, mimicking impacts by dropping objects onto a chunk of solid aluminum.
One, two.
Scientists here also simulate the vacuum of space and extreme temperatures. There is a lot riding on this LCROSS mission because the Mountain View site hasn't had a high-profile project like this in a decade. So if it goes well, that could be a huge turnaround for the Mountain View space program. Just getting this mission, Kolhapreet says, meant a lot to NASA Ames.
Oh, it was huge. It was huge. This is a small, rapid turnaround mission built to a cost cap, and we met that. It demonstrates a whole new element or flavor of mission that NASA can call upon to achieve its goals.
But there is one moment that could make or break the LCROSS mission, when the Centaur probe smacks into the moon. There will be one thing, Kolhapreet says, he will be desperately looking for.
Ejecta. Bright, glimmering ejecta coming up out of the crater and into sunlight.
That is, he wants a big plume of moon dust. This event will be monitored by a second space probe and by the Hubble telescope and by a number of telescopes on Earth, all waiting for the dramatic moment.
And you can see three of its moons.
At the Foothill College Observatory in Los Altos Hills, two dozen people gather every Friday night to see the stars.
You're going to be looking at a galaxy. It's called M104. It's also known as the Sombrero Galaxy.
Andrew Fracknoy is chair of the astronomy department here. He says that amateur astronomers will be an important part of observing this mission.
One of the variables that the citizen science is going to help us to understand is how bright did the plume get? And we'll know that by how small a telescope was still able to see it.
The impact should be visible from Hawaii to Texas, astronomers say, to anyone with a 10-inch diameter backyard telescope. Liftoff is scheduled for June 17th. And the control room at Moffett Field in Mountain View will be on high alert over the next few months, guiding the Centaur to the right spot until about October 22nd, when they get to crash the thing into the moon. For the California Report, I'm David Gorn.
And you can learn more about the LCROSS mission by following the link on our website at californiareport.org. This week marks the end of the year for most public schools in California. As any teacher or parent will tell you, budget cuts and layoffs have made it a very tough year for education. The downturn is hitting really hard on families in the border town of Calexico. That's 3 hours east of San Diego. As Anna Tintakalis of KPBS in San Diego explains, schools there are going far beyond reading, writing, and arithmetic.
Uplifting Mexican pop music blares from a car radio in the border city of Calexico. 5 years ago, this music reflected the mood of this town. Construction was booming and cross-border business was thriving. Not anymore. The region's skyrocketing unemployment and foreclosure rates, combined with the recession, have grounded everything to a halt. Schools are struggling, too.
This is the after-school program. We have a very large after-school program, about 200 students.
Alba Zazueta is principal of Kennedy Gardens Elementary School. She says parents traditionally sign their kids up for programs like this one that provides tutoring and help with homework. But now the district offers them as a form of free babysitting for families beginning in kindergarten. She says it's just one way local schools have become a kind of social safety net for families.
Our kinder classrooms, they used to be packed with parents before, trying to be involved in all kinds of activities. Now we hardly see them.
Zazueta says that's because moms and dads are either trying to find a job or working two jobs to make ends meet. She says in addition to providing free childcare and the necessary meals and snacks at school, some educators are also picking kids up for school or taking them home once classes end. David Grossbeck is superintendent of the Calexico Unified School District. He says Calexico families are resilient, but admits the economic circumstances are pushing many of them out. Some leave for Arizona, but most cross the border into Mexico.
A large percentage of our families have relatives in Mexicali. And so for them, there's a support system in Mexicali that families in other parts of the country might not necessarily enjoy.
Maria Martiz is one parent who's thought about moving back, Maria has four kids. She lost her job working in the fields. Now she lives with her sister.
No, está amplia la casa.
As for living in one house, it's okay for now. My sister has two kids. I have four of my own. Our husbands are both away looking for work right now. I'm not sure what job they might get, but anything is good as long as it brings money.
School officials say a large number of families are now forced to double up or triple up under one roof. In one case, there were 15 kids living in one house.
And this is closed like you see.
The district's Hortensia Armendariz is working to help families like that. She runs Calexico Unified's Family Resource Center. These one-stop shops provide needy families with social services like Medi-Cal and food stamps. Armendariz has also created her own arsenal of donated goodies.
Here's some school uniforms. We have jeans, like you see that, you know, it's really good condition. We have, oh, wow, this is nice. Don't you think so? I mean, we don't see too many clothes here. A lot of empty hangers, that means our families are taking advantage. I want our families to know that, yes, this is used clothes, but it's good clothes.
She says the silver lining is the residents of this border city are coming together to help those in need.
As long as we work together as a community and as long as there are agencies out there, I think our families are, they're going to have it hard, but it's not going to be impossible.
But other educators are not so optimistic for the next school year. They say state budget cuts are tearing into their spending plans, forcing them to scale back on the very people and services these families need. For the California Report, I'm Anna Tentakulis in San Diego.
China's democracy movement got crushed in Tiananmen Square 20 years ago last week. Still, every now and then, there are hints of democratic reform in China, and one of them can be found in Southern California. Each year, communist officials from the port city of Dalian fly to Los Angeles for classes on ethical governance and empowering citizens. The lessons are taught by Joaquin Lim, a city councilman from the L.A. suburb of Walnut. L.A. Bureau Chief Rob Schmitz sat in on a class and files this report.
Joaquin Lim looks positively energetic as he greets 25 groggy-eyed, mostly middle-aged male students in Mandarin. They muster a rather formal round of applause. Today's lesson? California's Open Meetings Law, otherwise known as the Brown Act.
California State Assembly.
Among those taking notes are vice mayors, party secretaries, airport managers, a sampling of the bureaucratic ladder in communist China. They'll spend 3 weeks here taking classes on how to foster democracy and empower citizens, all eye-opening topics for officials who, back home, allow little room for public dissent.
Back in Dalian, you know, these people walk on water. And for them to come into a classroom in California and sit there and have to listen to, you know, lectures about ethics and about empowering, you know, citizens, I give them credit.
Dalian is known throughout China as being a progressive city. But many other similar-sized cities in China are infamous for corrupt local officials who commonly take bribes and intimidate those who get in their way. Lim, who was born in China, doesn't harbor any illusions that his classes will transform the country overnight. But he says it's a good sign that China is willing to send officials here to learn. Back in class, Lim tells his students that most cities in California, like his, hold their city council meetings in the evening to make it more convenient for residents to attend. Sun Jun, the deputy director of Jinzhou, a district within the city of Dalian, shakes his head when asked if he'd consider holding evening meetings back home.
We have our meetings during the day while we work, and we don't publish any sort of agenda ahead of time. I recognize your meetings here in California are very democratic, but our meetings and your meetings aren't the same.
As a case in point, the next day, Lim took his class on a field trip to a Los Angeles City Council meeting.
That day happened to be Denim Day in Los Angeles City Hall. And council members, staff members, they were all in jeans. They looked at me and said, "Why are they not in suits?" And I said, "It's Denim Day." So what is Denim Day and why do they do that? I said, "Don't you have that in China?"
Apparently not. Another thing their city council meetings don't have are gadflies like this guy.
I'm here to tell you this is the big one, people. This is, people are going out in handcuffs over this.
One of the students leaned over to me and said that he looks very mad. I said, he is very mad. I said, could this happen in China? I said, oh, no, no way.
This cultural divide is evident when I, a Mandarin-speaking journalist, chat with students between classes. After a pleasant conversation about what it's like to be an American journalist, a bureaucrat in the back of the class chimes in.
He's actually serious. He wants me to be a representative of Dalian here in the United States.
In Los Angeles, in the United States.
Oh, that sounds like a very important job.
He just met me a half an hour ago, but the head of Dalian's state-run television network has offered me a foreign correspondent job. After 3 weeks of classes on ethical governance, this gentleman is offered a position with a salary equal to several times that of an average Chinese worker to a complete stranger. Old habits die hard. But other lessons have been learned in this class. One former student moved his district's public meetings to evenings to better accommodate residents. In this class, there looks to be some promise, too. Yuli Yan is a young, energetic vice mayor of Zhuanghe, a city of around 1 million outside of Dalian. She says before she came here, she didn't see much difference between how government was run in the U.S. compared to China.
But I've noticed that Americans have a heightened awareness of democracy and a highly ethical system. We're trying to learn from that in China. When I go home, I think I'm going to make sure that I do my best to heighten China's democratic awareness in my city.
She's not yet sure how she'll do this, but something in her eyes assures Teacher Lim she's serious. For the California Report, I'm Rob Schmitz in Los Angeles.
Artist Chris Cooper, a.k.a. Coop, moved from Oklahoma to California in the late 1980s and quickly became a fixture in L.A.'s pop art scene. He's best known for his rockabilly style, featuring lots of hot rods, voluptuous vixens, and wide-eyed devils. This month, a collection of his paintings is on display in Culver City. From KPCC in Los Angeles, Alex Cohen looks at the details behind those devils.
Chances are you've seen Coop's work before. His designs have been featured on concert posters and album covers for bands such as Green Day, Nirvana, and the Ramones. But perhaps his best-known image is that of a cigar-smoking devil. Coop says years ago, a friend was starting a company selling Zippo lighters and asked him to whip up a design.
I did this image. I did it very quickly, probably in 30 minutes or less. And I didn't even bother to make a copy of it. I just mailed off the original art to him and didn't think about it. And the original art ended up being lost for several years until somebody at Zippo found it in their files and mailed it back to me.
Coop's devil was a hit. It's since wound up on everything from T-shirts and stickers to shot glasses and air fresheners. But that success has its downside, too, Coop says. He says others have co-opted and profited from his devil image without his permission. That frustrating experience was the inspiration behind one of his new paintings. It's called 13 Devil.
The idea to me was just to kind of take back control of the image by sort of essentially destroying it.
The painting features one of his classic demons, but layered over it are stencils of multiple other devils and dotted patterns in vibrant purple and yellow. The result is dramatic and chaotic, a blurred cacophony.
There's a line in the science fiction book Dune where one of the characters says, "The only way to truly have power over something is to have the ability to destroy it." And that was something that kind of came into my head when I was thinking about this, was that obliterating it would sort of be a way for me to sort of take back a little bit of control over it and what it means to me.
Another theme driving the show is something Coop calls paint blogging, an activity he discovered as a result of a serious accident. 2 years ago, Coop was driving his 65 Ford Falcon when another driver blew through a red light.
I had a broken leg. I was on crutches for 4 months. And unfortunately for me, these paintings are so large that I paint standing up either on the floor or on a ladder, which of course I couldn't do.
While he recuperated, Coop turned to a less physically demanding art form, photography. He also started posting to the photo-sharing website Flickr, where he quickly gained a loyal following. Eventually, Koop started painting again, but he kept shooting and sharing photos, too. And then he turned his camera toward his canvas.
I started doing it purely for myself because when you're painting things that are this complex, it's often very helpful to sort of document the process so that if you need to go back and rework something, you sort of know the steps that you took to get to that point.
No more worrying about losing the originals, and he quickly discovered other benefits too. Koop's followers on Flickr started commenting on the photos of his works in progress. He realized the internet provided him a unique opportunity for feedback most artists don't get until their work goes public. For example, he says the evolution of his 13 Devil painting drew a lot of responses.
The photos went up and people said, "Oh, wow, I love this painting. I'm so glad you're finally doing this image." And then the next day, I came in and painted the dark purple line work on top of it and put a photo up. And people are like, "Well, why did you do that?"
Koop loves getting that immediate feedback, even if not all of it's positive.
In the past, I would just sort of do things. And later I would look at them and say, "Oh, well, I guess maybe that's what this means, this thing." But when I started very seriously blogging my painting, I started to become much more sort of analytical about what I was doing. And I think the work improved because of that.
The results of Koop's paint blogging are on display at the Corey Helford Gallery in Culver City until June 20th. For the California Report, I'm Alex Cohen in Los Angeles.
If you want to check out Koop's work, we have links at californiareport.org. A cappella singing, that distinctive style usually performed without instruments, has roots going back centuries. And it seems to be making a comeback. This fall, NBC will premiere The Sing-Off, an a cappella American Idol-type competition, and two feature films about a cappella are also in the works. The only nationwide post-college a cappella championship in the U.S. is held in the Marin County city of San Rafael. The Harmony Sweepstakes recently held its 2009 finals competition, and reporter April Demboski was there.
The smell of hairspray wafts from the backstage dressing rooms at the Marin County Civic Center Auditorium. Before the mirrors lined with light bulbs, the four young women of the San Jose Love Notes primp and curl. The group's lead singer, Mia Dessenberger, says audiences are surprised to see such a young, all-female barbershop quartet.
People think of us as the men in pinstripe suits with cute little hats, singing like "Goodnight, Sweetheart" all the time.
But these teenagers in tight dresses woo audiences with their complex harmonies and unconventional song choices.
Is this the real life? Is this just fantasy?
The Love Notes won the San Francisco Regional Championship of the Harmony Sweepstakes A Cappella Festival. They shared the stage with the seven other regional winners from around the country, including Three Men and a Melody, a barbershop quartet from Chicago. And Evolution, a six-member male a cappella group from Los Angeles. The Harmony Sweepstakes began 25 years ago when members of the Mayflower Community Chorus in Marin created a showcase of local a cappella talent. Interest grew over the next 5 years, so they asked local event producer John Neal to step in. What began as a casual get-together in 1984 is now a nationwide competition with thousands of fans.
They follow it quite closely. So winning the Harmony Sweepstakes in the a cappella community is quite a big deal.
The 2,000 people in the audience will pick their favorite, but the national a cappella champion will be crowned by five judges. One of them is Amy Engelhart, a singer with the Grammy-nominated a cappella band The Bobs. She came from Los Angeles to judge the group on a range of skills.
Originality, intonation, presentation, sense of humor, presence, professionalism. and your material, your choice of materials.
It's the Super Bowl of acapella.
That's Tim.
A.K.A. Mr. Tim.
Jones from the Denver Mouthbeats.
Acapella people are geeks.
And that's his bandmate, Matt Murphy.
Everyone is very friendly to each other, but they're still like, ugh, I hope I win, you know?
Jones and Murphy's group doesn't sing lyrics. They specialize in vocal percussion. They create rhythms by contorting their lips and flicking their noses like thumb pianos.
Things they do with their mouths. Sound like a band.
Molly Plummer is the tenor in Max Factor.
We feel like we're so out of our element. We're so in awe of these people. They're so good.
The four women in this barbershop quartet from suburban Baltimore range from their mid-30s to mid-50s. They sport matching French manicures and red pedicures. The sequins on their shoes sparkle under the stage lights.
When you wish upon a star, makes no difference who you are.
They volunteered to perform first, mostly so they could watch and learn from the other groups. But the judges saw things the other way around.
And the 2009 Harmony Sweepstakes Acapella Festival National Championship winner is Max Factor. Come on out, ladies.
The audience had their own opinion. They voted for their favorite, the San Jose Love Notes.
Come fly with me, let's fly away, up and away.
Past winners of the sweepstakes have landed gigs performing on the Carson Daly Show and the Food Network. One group signed a record deal with Sony. But the Bob's Amy Engelhart says that's really rare.
I still have no illusions that a cappella music is going to break into the mainstream, be this giant thing other than a novelty.
But with two television shows, two movies, and a book in the works, entertainment execs clearly think the new generation of a cappella is ready for prime time.
Come fly with me, let's take off in the blue.
For the California Report, I'm April Demboski.
Get you up there.
There's a video of the Love Notes performing Bohemian Rhapsody on YouTube and many more songs from the Harmony Sweepstakes. We've got a link to them on our website, californiareport.org. And that's our show for today. The California Report is a production of KQED Public Radio. The director is Susie Rocho. Tom Krimkowski is behind the controls today. We had additional engineering from Howard Gelman and Danny Bringer. The online editor is Gabriel Cohen. Our interns are Lacey Danielle, Nicholas Kuznets, Jeff Enlow, and Christina Ha. Andrea Kissick was a contributing editor this week. The producer is Victoria Malione, and the senior producer is Ingrid Becker. The executive producer is Raul Ramirez, and I'm Scott Schaefer. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend. This is the California Report.
Funds for the California Report are provided by the James Irvine Foundation, celebrating the 2009 recipients of the James Irvine Foundation Leadership Awards. More information is available at www.irvine.org. Chevron, an energy company founded in California more than 125 years ago, helping fuel California's way of life. More information is available at chevron.com. And the California Endowment, working to build healthier communities that support children, youth, and families. Online at www.calendow.org.